find this story.
Okay.
It's a little bit tricky, but let me find
okay.
it.
Okay. We were in the middle of my first love affair, which is so hysterical. I just love that story.
Oh yeah, because I wasn't here last week. That's
right, right, right. So we
is
were.
This the last. This is the last class.
This is the last class, right? Actually, let's start with. Do you have On America handy?
I'm sure I can get to it. Hang on.
Okay.
It'll just take me a second.
Yeah. No, take your time. I think. This is Shalom Aleichem. The guy had just an unbelievable sense of humor. It just incredible.
I know.
He's
he
really,
did.
Yeah. Yeah, just totally.
It's even more than a sense of humor. It's just a perspective.
Yeah. It's like an astute observer, you know.
On America. Let's see. I almost have it.
Okay.
I'm there almost.
Okay. Not a rush.
Let me just see. Okay. So 9 to 11.
Oh, okay.
I'm just going to print out On America.
So. Oh, that's a smart thing. Yeah.
Because it's too hard to read on the screen.
Right.
Because it's sideways.
Right. Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah, that's right. So just as a background point, so he married a wealthy woman. And she had inherited her father's estate, and they were wealthy. He lost it all. Some bad investments, some just, you know, lavish lifestyle. And so he, you know, pretty early on, he had to, like, really start using his writing to make a living, to support the family, and so on. But just sort of knowing that he had the perspective of somebody who had known wealth, and also the perspective of somebody who knows poverty
right.
Tells a lot about this one. But
I think that that's actually pretty significant.
Yes.
Because for a lot of people, they know one and the other. They don't know both.
Right. And I think about that sometimes, that he, you know, he must have, I don't know, would have been fun to meet him. I would have liked to invite him to dinner.
Yes, a very unusual person.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's see where we are here. I don't know where I am. It's coming.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. The
America's coming out as I speak.
Okay.
I'm one of the few people who has a printer in their office.
Oh.
Well, everybody else, we have to share.
Oh.
But I have.
Go Lynn. So do you know who's getting your office when you...
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't because I don't... There are other people who have to move out before I do.
Oh. So I see. Okay. Got it.
Okay. So On America.
On America. America is all bluff. All Americans are bluffers. That's what strangers say. All Americans are bluffers. Ain't it the truth, right? And it's so interesting because when you do these kind of cultural comparisons, you know, what we call manners or graciousness or, you know, and so on, you know, for example, the Israelis will think of as, you know, your BS masters, you know, why don't you just talk straight, you know, but, you know, so there's truth to it. And then there's, you know, not...
Not so true.
Not so true, right. So true and not true at the same time. Being greenhorns, they don't know what they're talking about. The fact is that America can't even shine Kasrilovka's shoes when it comes to bluffing. And our own Beryl Isaac could put all the American bluffers into his side pocket. So this Beryl Isaac thing is such a hoot. You know, so he is now the stand-in for all the BS artists, like, you know, par excellence, right? You'll realize who Beryl Isaac is when I tell you that if a Kasrilovkite starts jabbering a mile a minute, or as they say in America, talks himself blue in the face, he's shut up with these words, "Regards from Beryl Isaac." He gets the hint and buttons his lips. There's a story they tell in Kasrilovka, this is so hysterical, about a fresh lout, which tells a lot about Beryl Isaac. On Easter, the Christians have a custom of greeting one another with the news that Christ is risen. The other answers by saying, "True, he is risen." Have you heard this before? Like, is
Never.
This? No. Yeah. So interesting. Well, once a Christian met up with this fresh lout of a Jew and said, "Christ is risen," the Jew felt his stomach churning. What should he do now? Saying he is risen would be against his belief. Saying no, he's not alive, might get him into a pickle. So he thought about it and said to the Christian, "Yes, that's what our Beryl Isaac told us today." Just imagine, it was this very Beryl Isaac who spent a few years in America before he returned to Kasrilovka. Picture the wonderful stories he told about that country. So it's a way of, do we have an equivalent of Beryl Isaac in American culture?
I think so, probably.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who that might be. But I think there are people who sort of are framed in that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we term it more as...
Like Mark Twain?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or people who will say, you know, and if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you,
right,
you know, in Brooklyn,
right,
that kind of thing. So we have ways of saying it. I just can't think of the person, but I'm sure there is one.
When I do field work, one of my colleagues and I, somebody I've worked with for years, he's a geologist, we have this sort of patter we do when we're in the field. I mean, just, you know, it's fun.
Right.
And he has this tendency to, you know, we'll make up this whole thing. We'll talk about, oh, you know, you haven't lived until you've been to the feast. Museum. You know, we go through this whole thing that there's a whole map of all 50 states, each with its own cheese. And people believe it.
That's great. That sounds very fun.
It is.
Okay, so here we go. First of all, the land itself, a land flowing with milk and honey. People make money left and right. Beggars use two hands. They rake it in, and there's so much business there, it makes you dizzy. You do whatever you please. Want a factory? It's a factory. Want to open a store? Fine. Want to push a push cart? That's permitted too. Or you can become a peddler, even work in a shop. It's a free country. You can swell from hunger, die in the street. No one will bother you. No one will say a word. So what's so remarkable about that, among the many things, besides the funny part, is that he's put it in such a funny way that what goes with freedom is a degree of anonymity, you know?
Right. And that's true.
And it's true.
And we don't ever think of it that way.
Yes. Right. But he who, you know, if you're coming from Eastern Europe, the idea of somebody dying in the street who you don't know, or that you wouldn't do something about, it's like a, you know, amazing. Just skip down to... the third paragraph on the right side on 231. And their way of life, it's all rush and panic, hustle and bustle. Hurry up is what they call it. They do everything quickly. They even rush when they eat. They dash into a restaurant and order a glass of whiskey. I myself saw a man being served a plate which had something fresh and quivering on it. As the man lifted his knife, half of it flew off to one side, half to the other, and then put an end to that man's lunch. So what's the deal about hurry up is what they call it? Or
yeah,
they even rush when they eat. Okay, so America is always, you know, even from, you know, not just now. Now is crazy,
right,
but it's always that way. But also, they even rush when they eat.
That's true.
It is true. And it's amazing to somebody who has to, you know, treasure every morsel, you know? How can you possibly rush to eat, you know, right? When you're...
Although I've seen people who, you know, are very hungry and haven't had food, they also rush to eat.
That's true, too.
Because they think it's going to go away.
Right, right. And which is right. And so part of it is, if you look at Jews going to Kiddush, you'd think we hadn't eaten in a very long time.
You know? It makes me crazy.
But it's also that you can flick your knife and your whole lunch is gone. You know, the idea that you could, that food could be there and, you know, what
right.
is that? Okay. So, so just go to the next page. And this is amazing too. Not to mention the respect we Jews have there. No people are as honored and exalted there as the Jew. A Jew's a big shot there. It's a mark of distinction to be a Jew. On Sukkot, you can meet Jews carrying citrons and palm branches even on Fifth Avenue, and they're not even afraid of being arrested.
Which is really wonderful. Yeah.
Which is really wonderful, you know? It's like he's saying, what an amazing thing. You know, you're not even arrested if you pull out a Lululemon Etro. If I tell you that they love Jews, it has nothing to do with the fact that they hate a Jew beard with a Jewish beard and earlocks. Whiskers are what they call them. If they see a Jew with whiskers, they leave the Jew alone, but tug away at his whiskers until he has to snip them off. That's why most Jews don't wear beards or earlocks. Their faces are as smooth as glass. It's hard to tell who's a Jew and who isn't. You can't tell by the beard and by the language, but at least you can recognize him by his hurried walk and by his hands when he talks. I think that's great. But aside from that, the Jews, they're Jews down to the last drop. They observe all the Jewish customs, love all Jewish food, celebrate all Jewish holidays. Passover is Passover. Matzahs are baked all year round. And there's even a separate factory for the bitter herbs we use during that holiday. Thousands upon thousands of workers sit in that factory and make bitter herbs, and they even make a living from it. America's nothing to sneeze at. Of course, you know, they're sneezing at the bitter herbs that they're making
right,
in the factory.
Well, I know in my family, we had my mom had a blender that the only thing she ever made in it was horseradish.
Oh, yeah.
That's because it never was used for anything else. On Pesach,
Right. So what's the deal about matzahs are baked all year round?
Well, the notion that you could get a matzah, not Pesach, is...
Right.
It's bizarre.
It's bizarre. It's silly. Like, why would you want a matzah not on Pesach, right?
That's my question.
Yeah, I'm right there. And also, it's so, but it's also the thing you were there. You were there when we were at Blue Spring Manor. In Birmingham. Right. So like 5 years earlier, I would say, or whenever we started to go there. And before we sort of knew Doris and those people a little bit better, they knew that I was going to need some special, you know, I don't know, whatever it was, the plates or the this or the that. And that, and, you know, everybody would eat dairy, but I would eat like something else. The first time somebody, I don't know if it was Doris, but somebody brought out the first meal of that retreat. I think it was a lunch or something. It was, a little thing of grape juice, an egg and a matzah. You know, this is July, right? Because it's like, what's the Jewish, you know, what's the Jewish food? You know, and it's all, so part of it is that, and part of it is also all year round, because who knows when Passover is? I mean, you know, sometimes they know, but they're putting out the Pesach matzahs, you know, way before Purim.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing for this retirement thing. It's going to be a dinner, mm-hmm. and so I said, and a friend of mine said to me, he said, you know, you should make it so it's whatever you want. And so I went in and I said, you know, I don't want any meat there. Right. I don't want any meat in the room. I have people coming who are only going to eat vegan. I have people who are vegetarian. I said, the only non-vegetarian thing you can have there is salmon. Do salmon. And I said, it's really got to be cooked separately, et cetera. And they were fine with it.
Oh, that's great.
It was interesting, though. But then she said, well, do you want me to order kosher meals also? And I said, well, no, because those would be fleshy.
You know, otherwise they bring you airline meals or something. Yeah.
But then they, no, actually there's a caterer.
Oh, there is.
Restaurant who is a fleshy kitchen. Actually he's Middle Eastern. They're Lebanese.
Ah, interesting.
And they decided to have a kosher kitchen.
Amazing.
It's very interesting. So they cater anything on campus that needs to be kosher.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah.
But anyway, what she told me is, she said, you know, people are going to complain. And I said, yeah, they probably will. Mm-hmm. And some people will. And so she said, well, she said, my advice is this. She said, Joan Rivers used to do this act where she said, a man complained and complained and complained about some dinner. Mm-hmm. Right? And he kept complaining, and this is terrible, and this isn't good. Da, da, da. And so she then stops him and she said, you know, I am so sorry. And he kind of looked at her and she said, I had no idea this was your last meal.
That's funny. She's, God bless her. On the one hand, it's a great place for Jews. You can walk out the down the street without getting arrested. But it's also the place where Jews stop being Jewish also. You know,
which you really couldn't do where they were.
Right, right. And so, so you can, you know, you can, as we like to say, pass. And that's an amazing thing too, the idea of being able to, you know, just be there. Okay. Yes, Beryl Isaac, what you say is all very well and good, but just tell us one more thing. Do they die in America like they do here, or do they live forever? Of course they die. Why shouldn't they die? Just skipping down. As for dying, sure they die, but it's how you die. That's the thing. Dying is the same all over. It's death that kills them. The main thing is the burial. That's it. First of all, in America, it's customary to know where you're going to be buried. The man himself, while he's still alive, goes to the cemetery and picks out his own plot. He bargains for it until the price suits him. Then he takes his wife, goes out to the cemetery and says, see, dear, that's where you'll be. That's where I'll be. That's where our children will be. So, you know, in our day and age, to, you know, to go pick out your plots is like the responsible thing to do, you know. But then this is what my mother loves to say to us. So they have plots at Sharon Memorial Park in Massachusetts. And so my mother always takes care to say to us, yes, we have a really nice view from where we are. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Right. So, you know, the main thing is, you know, here's where you're going to be. Here's where, you know, as if, so
right,
for,
right.
To them, this was just totally funny. The main thing is the burial, right? As if, you know, somebody,
right.
the dead person will know. The next thing he does is go to the funeral office and order whichever class funeral he wants. They come in three classes, first, second, and third. The first class affair is for the real rich men, millionaires. It cost $1,000. That's what I call a funeral. The sun shines, the weather is lovely. The coffin lies on a black silver-plated catafalque. Now, did you know this word catafalque?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. See, you did. This is something that you would know. I never heard of it before. Yeah. The horses wear black harnesses and white plumes. The rabbis and cantors and sectons are dressed in white buttoned black outfits. Carriages follow the coffin, carriages without end. All the children of all the Hebrew school assemble at one point and they slowly sing the verse from the Psalms, "Righteousness shall go before him and shall set his steps on the way." This chant makes the town's rafters ring. It's no trifle, $1,000. So, you know, and then we get to the second class. They use the mournful Psalms melody as befits the $500 rate, you know. It's not going to be like the upbeat, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When my husband died, I went to the funeral home and I said, you know, and I said, you know, he tried to upsell me.
Oh, sure.
You know, and I said, I want a plain coffin, but my husband was big. And I said, you know, I'll go up a little bit because it's going to be, I wanted something with handles on the side, not just the plain.
Right, right.
So I said, that makes sense to me. Yep. That'll do.
Right.
And so we're going through this whole thing. And he says to me, and I don't even know what prompted me to do this, but he said, you know, in Wisconsin, you have to have a liner. In the grave line. And I said, yes, I understand, that's the law. Okay, fine. And so he said, well, we have several different options. And he said, you have this option and this option. And he said, with this option, he said, this is leak proof and, you know, all this stuff. And he says, and it's guaranteed in perpetuity. And I looked at him and I said, what? And he said, it's guaranteed in perpetuity. And I said, how many claims have you had?
Yeah.
He was so
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
I said, what do? Do you go check every once in a while?
I know.
Would you ever know?
That's really funny.
He said, well, I guess you don't want that.
That's really funny. I mean, but that's exactly it. You know, that's like exactly what he's trying to say here. You know, the idea that when you're dead, you're dead. And, you know, death is the great equalizer. You wouldn't know it in America because even in the funerals, you know, there's the upper class and there's the second and so on. So one is, you know, there's the money talks thing. Mm-hmm. There's the keeping up with the Joneses, you know, which is so true, you know, and the fact that you have choirs and carriages and so on, you know, and none of that, when you're dead, you're still dead. You know, it's like Francisco Franco is still dead, you know. And then just skip down to the third class funeral is a shabby one and costs only $100. The weather is cold and foggy.
I love the weather.
Right.
That's my favorite part is the weather.
Right. You can even order the weather in America. There are two horses and two reverends, not a carriage in sight. The children from one Hebrew school dash off their line without a tune. They mumble it so sleepily you can hardly hear them. After all, it only costs $100. What can you expect for $100? Yes, but what happens, Beryl Isaac, to a man who doesn't even have the hundred? He's in hot water. Without money, it's bad all over. The pauper is half dead and buried anyway. But don't get any wrong ideas. Even America, they don't let the poor man lie around unburied. They give him a free funeral. It doesn't even cost him a penny. It's a pathetic funeral, to be sure. There's no ceremony whatever. There's no hint of a horse or a reverend. It rains cats and dogs. Only two sextons come. The first sexton on one side, the second on the other, and in the middle, the corpse himself. Then all three drag their feet over to the cemetery. It's hell being born without money. It's a lousy world. By the way, can anybody here spare an extra cigarette?
I know, that's so funny. But it's so accurate.
It's so accurate. And also, it's hell being born without money, you know?
It is
hell being born without money. And, you know, as he's the guy who... you know, at one point could have done the $1,000 and, you know, and the $100 and the free one in between. Yeah. So just, you know, in terms of making fun of America, you know, he's got it 100% right. You know, it's the money, it's material things. And it's also the way we euphemize everything, and particularly death, you know, such that, you know, we're, you know, now at least we're talking about it, you know, after Being Mortal and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and so on. But, you know, for a long time, let's not talk about it, you know, let's not. And so that, you know, this idea that death is not part of life, that's such an American.
Yeah.
Who even? Yeah. Anyway, so he got it, you know, he got it just right on the nose. Okay. So now we're at my first love affair. Were you able to print that as well, or?
Yeah, gotta see what I'm. I've got my pages screwed up.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
Here.
I'll tell you what we covered until the half that we're gonna. The first part tells how this tutor gets the job. And and it goes through this whole thing about how he gets this job, and he interviews, and the thing that gets him the job is pull, you know, protexia.
Right.
I took the trouble to run over to my uncle's and asked him to ask his aunt to ask her friend to ask the relative to put in a good word for me with the in-law. You know, it's a friend's friends, mothers, sisters, fathers, you know. And then, you know, what we quickly realize is he's the only candidate for the job. There were no other candidates. But nonetheless, oh yes, grand and mighty is the power of pull, and lucky was he who had an uncle, who had an aunt, who had a friend, who had a relative, who had a rich in-law, who lived in a village, and
all,
Russian, German, and bookkeeping, who would not charge too much, you know, and the person has to be qualified, he has to be like, you know, an Oxford scholar, charge next to nothing, you know, it always has to be like, okay, everything, okay, so he gets to the house, and he sees the person who's going to be his protege, and the protege, once they're alone together, lays down the rules, which is, if you want to keep being my tutor and the guy needs the job, then away with the books. We'll spit on the ceiling, we'll play cards and checkers, but we're not doing we won't be doing any studying. And so the tutor immediately goes with the flow. And so they have a grand old time, and he gets food. You know, he finally is able to look into the mirror and see a pair of hefty cheeks. He doesn't even recognize himself because he gets to eat. Although there is the caricature of the woman with the keys who locks the pantry, who's, you know, basically starves him. Okay, and now the second half of the story is all about this. It's Cyrano de Bergerac, or the Steve Martin version of Roxanne, you know, where the literate person is writing on behalf of the person, you know, who can't articulate.
Right.
So it's on 135, the engaged couple's first love letters, the first spark is kindled. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which page?
135.
Wrong page. Okay. Yeah, got it.
Okay. Our one duty, though, was picking up the mail and answering the letters. And we had letters every day. I say we, for we both had to answer them. The letters were written to my pupil from his fiancée, although he himself admitted that he hardly cared for her. At first, the letters didn't come too often, once a week or once a fortnight. But after my arrival, the rate increased and letters started flying back and forth. Here, read it and answer her. What is she bothering me for? Said my pupil one day, throwing his beloved's letters into my face. I read the letter and liked what she wrote. My dear beloved fiancé, I am sick and tired of your letters, which are alike as if one mother had borne them. They are as alike as drops of water from a lake. I want to hear something different from you, a fresh word that will warm my heart and brighten my soul. For too cold is the heart, too dark the soul, from your faithful fiancé. Without delay, I answered thus for my pupil, my dear and faithful bride-to-be. You write that my words flow one from the other as if one mother had borne them. How can it be otherwise if one feeling gave them life? You say they resemble drops of lake water. How can it be otherwise if they stream from one fount, from one heart? You ask for something different, something new. Is there anything newer than the word love? Will your soul not be brightened if I think of you, beloved bride-to-be, from your faithful fiancé? To this we received a quick reply. My dear beloved fiancé, your sweet words refreshed and warmed me and brightened all the dark corners. So it's going to be, you know, and we just go from, you know, taking it to the next level and the next level and the next level. So go down to 7. Willy-nilly, a spark comes flying from God knows where and lands on a thatched roof. A little blaze starts. The wind comes and spreads the flames into a hellish conflagration. The first letters were the sparks which spread and burned into demonic flames. The letters became more and more fervent. The fire became more and more intense. An awesome fire blazed in my heart. Flames scorched my whole body. My blood seethed and boiled. I became sick. I wasn't myself. Lost my appetite. So the tutor is falling in love by letter, which is...
We're not sure what he's falling in love with.
Right. We don't know what he's falling in love with, and we will find out. Yeah. So a letter, but it's, you know, he's the great, you know, the classic thing of the lover. A letter turned a plain weekday into a holiday. I would open, read, and answer it. All my pupil had to do was copy it, and I had to urge him on. Carrying the pain deep down in my heart affected my health. I had to hide in my room and sit down. I had to hide in my room, my head buried in a pillow, and sob quietly, then rise, put up a cheerful front, and sit down to work with my pupil, a game of dominoes or 66. He has a tough life there. Luckily, no one noticed that I was fading away. And then, you know, it becomes my angel, my soul, my consolation, my dear, wise, and kind beloved, yours, dying with love. And this was her answer. Okay, so go to 138. And it becomes my life, my soul, my paradise, you know, and the language is just, you know, beyond. So 139. But don't you think it's high time to put an end to this letter business? I'm afraid that it'll turn out to be a collection of letters rather than a story. I just have one thing to say. These letters remain hidden to this very day in a corner of my desk. No man has ever seen them. They're as precious to me as ancient manuscripts, mute witnesses to my first joy and sorrow. They are dried and faded flowers on the grave of my first romance. So what happened in that paragraph?
Well, I mean, he realized that, you know, he couldn't continue like this forever.
Yeah. So he's our narrator, and he's in his narration. He's, you know, getting carried
way beyond where he should be.
Carried away, and so then he does. You know, it's like a Shakespearean aside. You know, like let's stop the action for a sentence so I can tell you.
Well, I
can tell you. So we'll readjust here. I wallow in lies and blush like a bride. A man's face will tell you if he's in love. Just look at his nose. See his eyes roll about. There's a queer smile on his lips. Ask him about tea, he'll talk about coffee. But no one noticed me. A few times, though, while we were playing checkers, my pupil asked me, "Are you all here? You're jumping over your own men." Surprised, I asked, "What men?" Then one night at the table, my employer pulled me aside and said, "Why the long face?" His wife, jangling her keys, faked a pitying expression. But deep down, she must have felt grand. "He hasn't been eating for the last few days," she said, because she's the one who always wants to stop him eating. it's overworked, too many books. You two sit locked up in your room for days on end. Take a walk. When do we have time for walks? If we have so much work to do, my pupil said. He looking so innocent that I suddenly felt like spitting into his face and shouted, God almighty, what liars you people are. One lie after another, one lie greater than the next. Right, which is so funny because, you know, he's become a master liar too. I'm homesick, right. I don't blame him. He has plenty to be homesick for. His family's not only the finest and the foremost family in their town, because what the father of the pupil had done was to say, this kid is the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. You know, it's, which of course he was nothing of the kind, but you know, this is to convince his wife that they need this right. kind of, you know, this kind of tutor. So,
Of course.
Right. So the wedding. So, right, the wedding always, you know, reality hits.
Yes.
He who has ever been half as much, 141. He who has ever been half as much in love as I will know my bittersweet feelings during the start of the wedding preparations. He who has carefully read the preceding chapters will know how I felt when my pupil had fittings for his wedding clothes, which took 3 weeks of constant sewing to complete. Compared to my pain, hell was paradise. And the torments of the grave were nothing at all. And he could say that authoritatively, right? No doubt you're saying it was caused by jealousy and hatred. God forbid. I knew very well that it was not my pupil she loved, but myself, the real author of the letters. So don't think I wanted to do away with my rival or poison him. God save us from such wicked thoughts. Okay, bottom of the page. I must confess that I thought of this day and night, expecting my pupil to step into a draft while perspiring, catch cold, start to cough, and develop a fever. It's like my mother had somebody she particularly hated in politics. And she would say from time to time, I don't exactly... you know, wish him ill, but should he drop dead of a heart attack one day, it might be okay, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, here he's thinking about his tutor and he's saying, I don't, you know, God forbid I should be jealous or wish him ill, or perhaps slip on a smooth pavement and break his neck or get a rock thrown at his head accidentally, right? So, so, and then go to the bottom of 142. But will you miss me? I asked my pupil. Surely, he said, and threw his arms around me. I'll take you with me. We'll have a great time there. We'll play checkers and go to the theater. I won't ever leave you. He lied through his teeth, and I knew it. Born and bred in lies, he just had to produce one more. And so now become the grand reception. And before leaving home, I had put into my pocket, don't be frightened now, it wasn't a pistol, God forbid, a letter to the girl. On 3 pages, I described the course of the romance and added a short autobiography. But how could I give her the letter? Through whom? When would she have time to read it? And the second to last paragraph, I was witness to the fact that the groom didn't fast. In fact, he helped himself to half a duck, but was telling everyone he was fasting. The lies are really phenomenal, you know? It's like he expertly faked the looks of a fasting groom who pondered deep matters. Born and bred in lies, he had to lie even on his wedding day. Meanwhile, the musicians had come and the ceremony of the veiling the bride began. The hullabaloo increased. Everyone was talking, everyone rushing. Hurry, hurry up, let's go, come on. They took us, I don't know who, and brought us, I don't know where. They told us something, but I don't know what. My head spun, tick-tock. The musicians were performing. The epilogue. Among all the people running back and forth and floating before my eyes, I noticed another lost soul wandering around as if he too didn't belong. Skip down to the bottom. A minute more, I thought, in another minute, all is lost. What a cow, the young man with the glasses suddenly whispered into my ears. Where do you see a cow? I asked him, looking all around. She's sitting right there, he gestured with glasses toward the bride. Seeing the bewildered look on my face, he whispered, she's an ass, a run-of-the-mill domestic animal, can't even write her name, she's a hellcat to boot, and look at the fine husband she's getting, you're his tutor, right? I don't know if I called him aside or vice versa. Perhaps we both moved away, but in 2 minutes flat, we were sitting opposite each other like old friends. All right, but her letters, I cried out. For God's sake, her letters. Hearing this, the young man held his side, laughing hysterically. Her letters? Oh, her letters? Oh, I can't take it anymore. Her letters? Then whose were they? Hers, he continued, laughing. Her letters? They were mine, my letters, mine. I thought that this young man had surely gone crazy and would soon throw a fit. And then the guy laughs again. Hers, her letters. Have you ever had a sweet dream where you see a beautiful palace, excellent food, finest wines, it's paradise, and then a she appears in the form of a golden-haired princess? You see a deep abyss, you're about to fall. This sweet dream flashed through my mind when the young man stood next to me, laughing at my letters and recounting the good girl's qualities. He laughed and my blood ran cold. One drop after another trickled out of my wounded heart and shattered spirit. In the hall, the musicians were performing, the violin moaned, the trumpet trilled, the flute whistled, and the bass drum boomed. And my heart was drained and empty, and there was gloom and darkness in every corner of my soul.
Poor guy.
Poor guy, poor guy. So, you know, even though this is...
They're both doing the same thing.
They're both doing the same thing, which is hysterically, you know, which is hysterical. It's a very measure for measure, you know, but in a Yiddish humorist way, you know, in Shakespeare, measure for measure is one thing, but, you know, and sometimes it's humorous too, but here it's just, you know, it's all based on the lies, you know, lies, 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 but, you know, the lie fits the lie. And so they're marrying exactly the people they should be marrying,
right.
One as illiterate
exactly.
as the other. Yeah, it's like providence, as it were, you know, facilitated by these respective lying tutors. So it takes the classic tropes, you know, like of the lovesick lover and so on, and just, you know, has you splitting.
Yeah,
totally upside down. It is just so, he is really.
It's interesting because it's very rare. You know, that's the thing. It's very rare to see somebody who uses humor the way he does.
Yeah.
You know, to make the really important points.
Yes, to make, right. Which is amazing. Yeah, because he is...
Yeah.
He is speaking, you know, to say measure for measure, you know, that's actually like a really interesting, important, and classic concept, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Starting with
yes.
ancient texts and going forward, and it's just that the way he does it, you know, is yet another sort of new take on measure for measure. Another way of helping us to laugh at ourselves, you know, for things we do, because, you know, we don't tell these like huge, huge lies and so on, but he wants us to know that, you know, we all have our, you know, we all have our Beryl Isaac moments, you know, where we're putting on the BS and so on.
Yes.
And, you know, and because he makes us laugh at it, he also allows us to see it, you know, and it's very affectionate. He's very affectionate about it. There's no, you know, you don't feel like any harsh judgment or anything here. That he's actually enjoying it. You know, he genuinely enjoys human nature, which is
mm-hmm.
just so wonderful. Yeah. So, all right then.
Perfect.
Okay. So, Lynn, have a wonderful party. Enjoy
Thank
every
you.
Second of it. And I'll get the lowdown from Dale after they come back.
Okay.
But big, big mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. You take care.
All right.
Okay.
Uh-huh, you
Bye-bye. Too. Be well.
Bye-bye.